Asia is really where it's at, where you can have the biggest impact and also where the biggest threats are at this time.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. And in this episode, we're continuing our month-long focus on Asia and the environment. That was the voice of David Emmett, Senior Vice President for the Asia-Pacific at Conservation International. David is a new but also essential part of the ongoing weekly conversation that is the Inside Asia podcast, because there's nowhere else on the planet where threats to the environment are more real and the impacts more severe than in Asia today. This might come as a surprise to some, but it shouldn't. On the one hand, there is in Asia a close proximity to the major drivers of environmental degradation, China, India, and Indonesia, just to name a few. But it's not just that. Put simply, and this is emphatically not a revelation, there are lots of people living in Asia, and that means a high demand for food, land, and water. Nowhere else is the challenge of balancing development and conservation more acutely felt and kept in a more delicate balance. Other regions face similar challenges, but if we compare, say, Africa, where we're talking about a population density of 2 million, compared to Indonesia, where it's closer to 280 million, you can see the magnitude of the challenge. You can also see why now is the time to talk about the issue. I start off by asking Conservation International's David Emmett about environmental protection and sustainability in Asia. Do people really understand what's at stake, and where are we in terms of the evolution of awareness in the region?
That topic is exactly why I started with in conservation, because when I was in Africa and I went to a national park and saw that the people had killed most of the animals, my immediate feeling was, well, how incredibly stupid and wrong and bad these people are destroying the nature. But then you realize that they need to eat. And actually, maybe some of the perceptions need to be changed there in the country about how they can get other sources of food, but also perceptions need to be changed globally, that people are not doing this, they're not just they're degrading the forest or hunting animals for fun because they don't care. Sometimes, in many cases, in fact, it's because they have no choice and they need to put food on the table or provide for their children, because that's what everybody wants to do.
But it's also there are people who are killing for trade, and it's just really more kind of how much money can I make off this rare turtle?
Right, and that's the other side of it. And that again is when communities actually often get exploited, where somebody would come in. We have this everywhere. You know, we could call them a middleman who would come into a village and say, I'll pay you $5 for every turtle or $50 for every bear that you hunt. And the communities are actually desperately poor, so they do that. And then if they're arrested, they're punished, but the middleman doesn't get anything. And so in a way, you're actually exacerbating the problem. So the really difficult thing with wildlife trade is targeting either the drivers of it in the wealthy people who want to eat turtle or shark fin, or, you know, stopping it at the level of the people who are actually driving the trade. Because often the people who are out there in the forest hunting don't necessarily want to do it. They just need a source of income.
And this is a global issue across, again, all developing markets, early stage where people are poor and they're looking for ways of managing their lives and grappling with these challenges. But it's been an ongoing issue, and it seems to cycle with economic progress. When there's downturns, you see an increase in these types of illegal trades. When there's the economy is doing well and people have alternative forms of making money or agriculture or farming or trade, they're fine. So at the end of the day, is it about just stable economies, or is this just too simple of a solution?
I think that's part of it. It's tricky how, the actual trade, for example, wildlife trade, there are people out there who've got enormous stockpiles of rhino horns and elephant tusks. And the fact that the amount of those products on the market is much, much, much lower than what is actually being hunted. So the fact is, there are people whose purpose in life is to drive rhinos to extinction, because then they know that their stockpiles of rhino horn has a finite... It's a finite resource suddenly, and it makes it so much more worthwhile.
Supply and demand.
It's absolutely. And I find that probably one of the most despicable components of this whole mentality, that literally that it's more about people getting the best return on their product than actually caring that one of the most charismatic species in Africa is being literally wiped off the face of the planet. Mm. And that's something that is very difficult to reconcile. The only way to deal with that really is to have extremely strong law enforcement and have countries where the trade is rampant, doing something about it. Just like China and Hong Kong have recently just put in place a ban on the sale of ivory, that's going to have slow at first, but probably quite significant ripple effects.
But it took them 25 years to do that.
And that's always the challenge, that then when there is enough either political pressure or there is a reputational benefit to doing something, and then eventually, you know, the pros and cons are sort of outweighing, so that it makes sense for them to make a decision like that. And that can be quite frustrating, because you feel like we should be doing this based on what we know to be right. And sometimes that's not always the case.
Is it a matter that sometimes things just have to get that bad before there is perhaps public pressure that comes to bear and governments then respond accordingly?
I think that's very true. I think that we as a species, people are generally fairly short-term in the way we think, and not meaning that we don't plan our own lives, but if we talk about the impacts of climate change and say that 20 years from now it's going to be extraordinarily bad, we can't really conceptualize that, and we feel like we can't do anything about it necessarily, so we're just going to shrug and say, well, it's either our future selves' problem, or we'll use technology to solve it, or we'll apologize to our children. But it's something that is so big and so sort of out there that we almost don't know how to grasp it. So we don't. It's almost like, you know, these bigger concepts like death or something, and we kind of avoid it because we don't feel like there's anything we can do about it. But actually, only when it comes to really you confront it very close up, then you realize, oh, we need to do something about this, and we need to change our behavior.
Conservation International has an interesting little spin on what it does. It talks about protecting the environment in the interest of humankind. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it's and I think there's been a lot of confusion sometimes about the thought that we're actually saying that we don't care about species, or we don't care about nature for its own sort of its own right. But what we're saying is that, for example, if you try to persuade a government that a massive area of forest is really important because it contains endangered frogs, the chances of them actually cancelling concessions and protecting the area is very minimal. But if you show that the benefits downstream from fresh water or support to the rice paddies, or the fact that they could get a lot of money from carbon credits, or that the forest products are worth a lot of money. So if you actually turn that argument round and present it from an economic perspective and show how conservation of that forest or that reef system has a direct benefit to poverty alleviation or food security or jobs or economic growth, then those are the sorts of criteria that the government is thinking about on a daily basis, rather than endangered frogs.
So changing the discussion from proselytizing to operating in your own self-interest.
Right. And that's a key point to it. And then again, though, it doesn't mean we're not trying to protect these areas because they're important in their own right. That's actually the underlying rationale for the reason why CI works in the geographies where we work, but then it's more about how we articulate it and how we present it to show people that it is in their enlightened self-interest to manage these areas. Because the fact is, if they do destroy the watershed above South Africa, they're going to find themselves severely limited when there's a drought like there is now. Or if you do destroy the mangroves and then there is a big storm, you're going to find that 2 kilometers inland, the communities suddenly find their houses washed away. So there is actually a strong link, and it's a very clear and obvious link between managing and protecting nature and the benefits it provides to people. So it doesn't mean that we're sort of just thinking of people. We're just articulating it because it's the people that we need to think differently about.
Is this entirely new, or for the last 50, 60, 70 years, haven't, you know, NGOs been advocating that this is actually in your interest? Or is there a flipping and saying it ain't working, we've got to do this differently, and the only way to do it differently is to articulate things in economic terms?
In terms of, say, last 30 or 40 years of conservation, back in the 1980s, there was a strong push to identify areas that were really full of endangered species and then basically protect them, set up a protected area, build a wall around them and say, this is now protected. The fact is that the main threats to that particular area don't come from within that area. The drivers of deforestation or coastal degradation come outside of that. So the focus has been more and more now on saying, well, okay, we have a protected area, but that's part of a much bigger landscape or seascape. So you need to look at the larger geographic area, because you need to connect the corporate investments in palm oil in the degraded forest outside, or the shade grown coffee, or the tourism, and show that it's part of, that conservation is part of a bigger package. Because just sort of saying this block of forest is really important, we're gonna, you know, protect it and no one's allowed in and out, ultimately that's taken a chunk of land out of any use at all, and it's taken it out of context as well. So presenting the whole picture of how protected areas and forests and nature in general fits into a larger landscape is the key thing.
And that's, I was looking at some of your marine conservation programs, and you have something called Ridge to Reef, which seems to have all aspects of that entire ecosystem. Could you explain that thinking a little bit? Let's get right down into, you know, some of the programmatic things that you're doing in the region.
Absolutely. And if anyone has been lucky enough to go snorkeling or diving in West Papua, in the islands that they call the Raja Ampat, you'll see incredible...
That's in Indonesia.
In Indonesia, yes. It's absolutely beautiful. It's got 70% of all the world's known coral, hard coral species and coral reef fish species. It's the absolute center of biodiversity, and it's a stunning place. Now, no matter how hard we try to protect that area, and we have tried, and we've done it, I think, with partners and local communities, it's done really well. It's now one of the best managed marine areas on the planet. All of our work will be wasted if the forests just inland are cleared for palm oil, because the heavy rainfall there, the monsoon, is going to wash silt out. It's going to cover the reefs and it's all gone. Or at a global level, if the forests are all cut down and then that increases climate change, then you end up with extreme events and bleaching and the corals are all gone. So we realize that there is an absolute connectivity, and it makes perfect sense between from the mountaintop all the way down to the coast and out to the reefs, and even out beyond to the sort of the deeper water where you have all the tuna fisheries and so on. And if you manage one piece in isolation, say we're just protecting the reefs and you don't do anything about what's happening on the land, you'll end up having wasted all of your efforts.
Aren't you in a situation, though, now that you've kind of extended the objectives and so many moving parts and so many different communities now have to get into play, that you're at risk of at least not being able to do something?
The biggest change, I think, in the way we were working in the 1980s and even until probably 15 years ago to now, compared to how we do it now, is that we are much more focused. If you look at how it was on a map in the past, it was like, you know, it was like measles. There were spots on a map all over the place. And we were working on little projects that only had minimal impact. And what we've said now is, let's not do that. And let's focus all of our efforts on a small subset of landscapes and seascapes that are the most important. So the largest evergreen forest in Indochina, the largest evergreen forest in Indonesia and Philippines and Pacific.
Sacred spots.
Yeah, the places that basically they are, it's like, you know, if you're gonna double down and say these are the places where we have limited time and money, where do we get absolutely the most bang for our buck?
This is Inside Asia, and my guest is David Emmett, Senior Vice President for Asia Pacific at Conservation International. Let's get back to our conversation. In the second part of our discussion, I pressed David on a topic that has been a bit of a controversial subject for CI, namely its propensity to work with corporations that have a less than stellar and often downright abysmal environmental record. Here's his response.
If we work with the companies that are doing a brilliant job and that have a great reputation for environmental sustainability, there's not really any added value we can provide, because they're actually doing a great job and we can highlight and profile it so people know this is a good company, they should buy that product.
But then, so you don't seek them out?
We don't necessarily seek them out unless they are asking if they can then expand their activities into an area where we work, because that would be a great partner.
But you do approach those who don't necessarily have great environmental track records.
Correct. And we would ask those companies if they would be interested in changing their approach, because they are, by definition, the the companies that are really large and that whose actions are actually having the biggest negative impact. So if we're going to actually address those negative impacts, we have to directly work with the companies or the governments that are actually driving that.
So I'm cynical, right? Culprits, right? You see this and you wonder, is this because it's a corporate social responsibility thing? I'll lose customers if I don't, or now the press is so bad, I've got to do something and I'm going to knee jerk and I'm going to, you know, bring in a Conservation International to make me look better. Or are there actual, you know, examples that you can give on where an organization that may have had a bad rep and bad track record actually changing their ways and actually driving change?
That's a really good question. And the way we need to work always is to absolutely be clear that we're not interested in greenwashing anyone's activities. So if a big company comes to us and says, look, we're interested in working with you because we've got a bad reputation, we would then say, well, you know, how far are you willing to go? And there are a lot of companies, big, well-known companies that have come to us and we've said, well, if we're going to partner with you, we need to see change. We need to see dramatic improvements in your corporate and social environmental best practices, in the way you do business in these companies, in the places that you source your products, etc. And if there isn't actually any commitment by that company to actually make that change, but they're saying, well, can we just give you $5 million to do a little project and then everyone's happy, then we have to just say no. And we've turned down a lot of offers of millions of dollars to do a project because you can quite clearly see that those companies, first of all, that $5 million or whatever is maybe 20 minutes of profit on an annual basis. So it's nothing to them, but also they're not actually willing to change their behavior at all.
So you hold them accountable. They put it into writing. They make commitments and you hold them there. And otherwise, what, they forfeit their contributions?
Absolutely. So we've had some partnerships that have succeeded very well, and I'll mention those. It's ones like Starbucks and Walmart.
And could you describe those?
Absolutely. So Starbucks came to us and wanted to work with us on a demonstration project on shade-grown coffee, saying that instead of clearing forests and growing coffee, they could actually grow coffee from beneath the canopy. And that's worked extremely well to the point now where Starbucks is, and it's, people don't even know this sometimes, is that they're about 99.9% sustainably produced shade-grown coffee. And they're working, they don't give us the money for this work. They work directly with the smallholder coffee producers in everywhere from Kenya to Brazil to Indonesia. And they are, again, within the landscapes where we work. So the communities in the forest, instead of them going out and hunting turtles or tigers or whatever, they're actually getting a really decent income from protecting the forest and growing coffee that they can then sell at a premium.
So what came first? Was it the fact that, hey, we don't have to have cleared forests in order to grow coffee? Or was it we're getting a lot of flack for clearing forests and therefore let's come up with a strain that grows well in shade and let's promote that aggressively?
I think what it was started with was there was a recognition that areas for growing coffee are becoming increasingly limited. And actually with climate change as well, areas where that are suitable for coffee are becoming few and far between. So they were saying that rather than going in and clearing forest, which is in an area that's suitable, which is what they absolutely didn't want to do, they wanted to find out if there was a way of expanding the areas that they actually have coffee produced in a way that's also maintaining the nature. So it was literally saying, can we grow more coffee without destroying the nature that they also realized they rely upon because it provides them with the year-round flow of fresh water that coffee plants need, et cetera, et cetera.
What's the Walmart example?
Walmart was a couple of examples that we worked on with Walmart where they started working with us on sort of topics around sustainability, basic sustainability of their practices, that their businesses and more about making themselves more efficient. But then we started talking to them about things like, for example, where they source their beef from. Is the beef coming from areas of Brazil where the forest was cleared? So then they said, okay, that they would no longer source beef that comes from areas of previously cleared rainforest in Brazil, which meant that suddenly, and that was a huge, the market that they have is so large that suddenly it just dramatically reduced the amount of forest clearance because people had been cutting it down to produce beef to sell to Walmart, but then suddenly that entire market stopped. So literally people stopped cutting the forest down, and then they were having, you know, were focusing on more intensification of beef, and, you know, because actually it's possible to do it in the right way, but you have to invest a little bit more, so your profit is slightly less.
David, you mentioned multinationals, Starbucks, Walmart, others. McDonald's in Latin America is also involved in some degree. What about Asia corporations? Are they embracing this? Or if so, where? If not, why not?
That's a very good question. And we've had a lot of discussions with a range of Asian corporations. Global corporations based in Asia, again, groups like Starbucks, et cetera, they are absolutely all over this. Within Asia, a lot of the Asian corporations, it's still quite nascent, but over the last two or three years...
Nascent because they don't have the understanding, or they're not in that cycle of development where they feel like they have the liberty or the opportunity to give back. What is, because there's some very wealthy Asia corporations, conglomerates, in fact, it's shocking how much money is available.
I think some of it is because of the, I guess in a way, it's almost like the lack of awareness. So that if, for example, a big US-based company or a European company does something that has negative impacts and then the press are all over it, then it can have enormous impacts on their bottom line. The awareness of, for example, within countries in the Asia region, people hadn't really been looking so much at where the products they used were coming from and whether it was sustainable or not. And that's partly because it wasn't having a direct impact on their lives. It was very interesting, I think, about 3 years ago where the haze in coming from North Sumatra was so bad that schools in Singapore and businesses and tourism was seriously hit, and people were actually, their lives were being compromised. They couldn't go out, they couldn't breathe the air, their businesses were suffering. And suddenly people started looking and saying, hey, you know, this paper, this you know, toilet paper or this product is coming from that particular area. So the pulp and paper or the palm oil or whatever is actually that I've been buying has been contributing to the bad air that my family are having to breathe. And then people start to have that change in mindset.
Well, there it is. It has to be in your face. It has to be very present, very immediate for people to start to take notice. And then the public pressure comes. We've seen this all across China, you know, with the levels of pollution. Finally, people are fed up and the government's stepping in and investing heavily in water treatment, cleanup projects and whatnot. But you also alluded to something where, you know, multinationals might have been called out. The press might have got onto a story, investigative journalism. Are we alluding to the need for more open, free press in Asia in order to point out where the travesties are occurring and hold them accountable?
I think social media is now so common. I mean, everybody has, not everybody, but almost everybody has a phone that allows them to take photos and immediately post it online. So in the past, if a company did something in the heart of Borneo that was kind of out of sight, out of mind, they'd get on with it. Nobody knew, and if they knew, there wasn't a way of it getting mainstreamed. Now, things happen. A company does something that's not following the right practices. People go out there, they take photos, it goes viral, and suddenly that company sees a massive reputational hit and their bottom line plummets. Then they would say, okay, we're changing our behavior. We're no longer growing palm oil endorsing the planting of palm oil in areas that have been cleared of jungle. We're only sustainably sourcing palm oil. Whether they're doing it because they suddenly care for orangutans or they actually are very, very conscious of their image and the impact that has on their reputation and their bottom line is obviously open to debate. And I think it's clearly, in many cases, it's the latter. But if the end result is that the deforestation in Borneo is massively reduced, because any palm oil grown there, the buyers are not actually buying it, then that's a good thing.
But you're also pointing to social media activists, people who, you, by virtue of using their phone, being alert, pushing around images that kind of demonstrate that there's a problem at hand, that can have an impact. Is there one that comes to mind, or have you seen this take root, or has, based on something like this, almost like an Arab Spring situation, albeit Asian environment?
There's a couple of, there's an example from Indonesia where not any one specific company, but a range of companies that were really highlighted for their products sourcing palm oil from areas that were cleared peat swamp forest. And I think most people now know that peat swamp forest, when you clear it, it then all of the carbon dioxide that's been stored in the 4, 5, 6, 7 meters below ground is then released. So 1 hectare of forest cleared there is equivalent to hundreds of hectares of forest cleared elsewhere. It's an extremely bad thing for the environment. That became such a social issue that in the end, most of the major palm oil sourcing companies that were buying palm oil from Indonesia, at least global companies, said no, they weren't going to source that. It was too big of an environmental and reputational risk. And then in the end, the government of Indonesia has said, okay, well, we are stopping making it illegal to have any further deforestation on peatland, peat forests, because partly because it's reputationally bad for them, and also because nobody wants to do it anymore anyway. So that's an interesting example where working directly with a government can take a little bit of time sometimes, but the social pressure and the corporate pressure can actually speed up the decision-making process and make it much more effective. So that's an example where sometimes people say, well, what can I do to help? But you realize everybody has a voice, and we can all make our voices heard one way or another.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Fantastic rundown on Asia. We wish you great success.
Thank you very much.
I'm Steve Stein, and that was my conversation with David Emmett, Senior VP for the Asia Pacific at Conservation International. And now it's time for our Inside Asia Minute, that moment in the show where we take a shot at making sense of what we've just heard, where I try to put the conversation, if you will, in context. Let's start by saying that the situation in Asia is dire. It's a kind of perfect storm. On the one hand, you have the most invaluable array of, let's call them, things that need protection, be they irreplaceable corals or deciduous forests or disappearing species of web-footed lemurs. I'm no lemur expert and don't know, in fact, if they're actually web-footed, but that's besides the point. If there were such a thing as a web-footed lemur, we would absolutely need to protect it. But it's not that easy, particularly in Asia. There's population and density and a push towards development that puts those same things in danger of being wiped off the planet. The question of what to do about this and what to do about it now is a pressing one. Q Conservation International. CI gives us a model, and more than that, it gives us an avenue of approach. CI's spokesmen say they're protecting the environment in the interest of humankind. Their critics contend that the natural world should be protected for its own sake. Well, maybe that's true, but I think it also misses the point. CI says it's all about impact. In other words, how you get it done shouldn't get in the way of getting it done. First, you have to convince people that it's in their own self-interest to protect the environment. Then you have to figure out the best way to do it. Governments are too slow, and NGOs are typically too constrained. That leaves the private sector. Say what you want, but corporations have been forged in the fires of competition, and by virtue of this, they've learned a few things about taking an idea to market. If the market in this case is the environment, why not engage companies to lend their managerial, financial, and operational expertise in the name of environmental sustainability? As long as they don't miss the point and end up turning Indonesia's rainforest into a furniture mart, then maybe public-private partnerships can make a difference. This is all to say that if the plan is to protect the web-footed lemurs, you will need Walmart, Starbucks, and yes, maybe even Exxon Oil. That's anathema to purebred conservationists, but time is not on our side. If we don't harness all possible resources to address environmental degradation now, we'll find ourselves 20 to 30 years down the road wallowing in smugness while living in a world void of forests, fresh water, and natural resources. We created corporations to satisfy our every product and service need. Perhaps now is the time to tap them to preserve the environment and rescue humanity. Tall order? Absolutely. But what choice do we have? Can we afford to wait for something better? Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you to come in from the outside on Inside Asia.